So this has been an adventure, and you know, quite frankly, I did not read the book before starting the class. I had only skimmed through it, so I didn't really know what we would be facing and what sorts of things might be raised. And we have to admit there's been some substantial arguments that have been raised, but by far there have been far more insubstantial arguments that have been raised. So I feel I'm really happy that we've done this. I feel glad that we took this on, because at least personally I feel more confident in my faith in Yeshua as the Messiah of Israel after having studied the objections and finding them to be, for the most part, without much merit. This was particularly so, a good example of this was last week's class, which I had, you know, like I told you last week, scarcely prepared for. Yet, the preparation that I did do, I simply was not finding the correspondences that Asher Norman was citing. And so, you remember what those correspondences were? They were correspondences between the gospel story, the person of Yeshua, and the description of his ministry and miracles, his death and resurrection, damning correspondences between that and all sorts of pagan mythologies. And so the allegation was, from reason number 24, was that Jesus appears to have been harvested from the Bible, which we pled guilty to. Yes, he's has a lot of affinity with the Bible. Yes. And mystery religion, God-men, which we didn't plead guilty to. There was that disturbing December 25th motif running through a lot of the mythologies, yes. We did see that. But beyond that, and beyond a general sort of agricultural, cyclical archetype of the agricultural god that dies in the winter and rises in the spring sort of thing, we weren't finding the correspondences. And I was actually kind of, you know, frustrated by that, because it felt like I must be missing something, you know, and if I had only had more time. So I went back to it the next day and just spent more time on the internet, you know, plugging away, doing my internet scholarship, junk internet scholarship. And I came across three excellent websites that take this on. So they take on the questions of these correspondences. And so I put these on here for you to take a look at. Just, you know, and I can't vouch for the material on the websites beyond the fact that they carried some excellent refutations of these correspondences, these alleged correspondences between mythology and the gospel. And even more, they went further. They went further even than Asher Norman's. Apparently, this is sort of a hobby of people, is to claim that there's some sort of pagan correspondence to the gospel. Because I guess the idea is, if you can find, oh no, this is actually about the Greek god Adonis or something like this, then you feel free to dismiss the gospel. And so everyone takes a run at this, it seems. And so these websites did the homework. And one of them had an interesting offer of, he was offering several thousand dollars to anyone who could actually produce one of these, you know, solid evidence of one of these correspondences. And, you know, he said, here's the rules. It has to be from, you know, it has to be solid scholarship that documents primary sources. Okay? So those are the rules. But beyond that, you know, just prove one of these things. Nobody could. You know, for all these people who are out there like freaking Gandhi writing these books, nobody could cash in. So, interesting stuff. I was much relieved to find out that someone else had done the work.
next project.
Yeah, not my next project. Another thing that I think a lot of these people bank on, and this is true for a lot of junk scholarship and the Dan Brown kind of approach, is they make such an overwhelming amount of absurd claims that anyone who looks at it, your average a scholar who is informed in the area would look at it and just dismiss it right away. And so then the layman looks at it and it's got all this documentation and all these footnotes and everything, and it's just beyond his scope to think of trying to go verify these sources, you know. It must be true, it had footnotes, you know, that sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing that we're facing tonight as well. Junk scholarship, yep. I'll give you two names. Chaim McCobe, he's the author of Paul the Mythmaker, which we've seen some of in this book. He's a Jewish writer. And then James Tabor is another. I hesitate to say that because I know the CD will end up in his hands or something because of that or something. But no, he's James Tabor, not so much a junk scholar as a sensationalist. Loves to jump on any sensational thing and kind of blow it out of proportion. And so his great contribution to the junk scholarship movement is the book, The Jesus Dynasty. But he's a legitimate scholar, actually. James Tabor, he's an archaeologist, he's a legitimate scholar. And I'm sure McCobe is too. It doesn't mean that the stuff they're presenting is accepted by other legitimate scholars. It's kind of like this stringing along little ideas. You'll see tonight how we do it, how they do it. Because the reason I bring these two guys up is because reason number 25 is based upon their two books, The Jesus Dynasty by James Tabor and Revolution in Judea by Chaim McCobe. They do come out with some far-fetched, like, crazy ideas. You know, complete reversal reinterpretations, like, it's not what you thought at all, it's totally different. I know it sounds like me, but which defy, like, the accepted understanding of the gospel. So James Tabor is going to work with this, like, a genealogy of Jesus, and very similar to Dan Brown kind of stuff. And I have not read Chaim McCobe's book, but I pretty much know the contents of it from tonight's reason number 25. What is reason 25? The gospel strongly suggests that the Romans considered Jesus to be an anti-Roman zealot. All right. So, I still don't quite get why this is a reason that Jews don't believe in Jesus. Yeah, I mean, even if he's not an anti-Roman zealot, first of all. But if he was, how would that disqualify him from being Messiah? In fact, it should actually enhance the qualification a little bit. So, Reason 25, and he's going to develop this quite a ways, we're going to move through it rather quickly. Reason 25 of, well, he was a anti-Roman zealot, actually, and that's why he was killed and so forth. That's why he was tried and executed. I suppose it works on this basis. Here's the logic. The Christian claim, the gospel claim, is that Jesus died. He suffered and died for the sins of the world. If you can demonstrate that he did not suffer and die for the sins of the world, but rather suffered and died for being a terrorist, because he was a terrorist, then you have discredited the gospel claim. So that's the logic that we're proceeding under here. So how is it that we come to this conclusion that Jesus was a anti-Roman zealot? First of all, by the titles he used for himself. For example, the Christ, which is Mashiach, which is Messiah, which is a king. And so if he's claiming to be king, well, that's in defiance of of Roman law. But let's think about, just because it amuses us, let's think about this for a moment. Reasons that Jesus isn't the Messiah. He claimed to be the Messiah. That's the first one here. That's the first one right off the bat. Okay. Likewise with the second one, that he was referred to as the King of Israel. Likewise with the next one, that he's referred to as the Son of David, and the Son of David is a king. Likewise with the next one, despite the typo, he was the Son of God. He's called Son of God, which is understood as a Davidic title for Messiah, according to Psalm 2:7. Son of God is a name of the Davidic king, a title for the Davidic king is what I meant to say. And likewise with Son of Man, which is a character from Daniel, from the book of Daniel, that is given dominion, which is kingship. So all of these titles imply authority. They imply kingship, right? And if he's claiming these titles of kingship, that must thereby put him at odds with Rome and with Roman authority. Well, yes, that's true. All of that is true. And in fact, this is the basis on which he is eventually crucified. It's the only charge that they can make stick to him, is that this man claimed to be a king. And so this is the basis on which he's crucified. That is true. So how else do we know that he wasn't just claiming to be king, but that he was actually an active terrorist fighting against the Romans? First of all, association with John the Baptist, who is a known terrorist. You might not have realized that John the Baptist was a known terrorist, but first he points out to us that Jesus and John, although they were associated, they actually were rivals in leading their different terrorist cells. And the proof of that is John 3:22 through 24, and John 4:1 to 2, if somebody wants to. Well, we can look those up. Antiquities 18:5-2 tells us the story of John the Baptist as well. Maybe we'll read that because that's interesting. Now, some Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God, and that very justly, as a punishment of what he did against John, that was called the Baptist. For Herod slew him, who was a good man, and commanded the Jews to exercise virtue. This was John. He commanded the Jews to, 1, exercise virtue, 2, both as righteousness towards one another, and 3, piety towards God, and so to come to baptism for the washing, that the washing with water would be acceptable to him if they made use of it, not in order to the putting away of some sins only, but for the purification of the body, supposing still that the soul was thoroughly purified before him by righteousness. Now when many others came in crowds about him, for they were greatly moved by hearing his words, Herod, who feared lest the great influence John had over the people might put it into his power and inclination to raise a rebellion, for they seemed ready to do anything he should advise, thought it best by putting him to death to prevent any mischief he might cause, and not bring him into difficulties by sparing a man who might make him repent of it when it should be too late. Accordingly, he was sent a prisoner out of Herod's suspicious temper to Machaerus, the castle I before mentioned, and there was put to death. Now the Jews had an opinion that the destruction of Herod's army was sent as a punishment upon Herod and a mark of God's displeasure against him. A punishment for killing John. So that's Josephus on John the Baptist, which accords very well with the Gospel's presentation of John the Baptist. And the allegation that's being raised here is that this proves that John was a revolutionary. How does it prove John was a revolutionary? Because Herod had him put to death for fear that because John drew such large crowds. Now we can imagine, because we see the exact same thing happening in the Gospel where the Master starts drawing crowds of 4,000 or 5,000 at a time. So when Herod sees this, he's afraid that John is going to start a revolution. But that's not what John was doing. Josephus tells us very clearly in the same passage what John was doing and what his message was, which was a call to repentance and a call back to Torah. So it's kind of amusing in that regard that the same passage that you would use to claim he was a revolutionary claims that he wasn't a revolutionary, that he was a good man that died unjustly. In the Gospels, we know a little bit more about the story. We know that Herod had him arrested, not just because he could draw large crowds, but I'm sure that was the major point, but because he began to teach those large crowds, it is not lawful for Herod to have his brother's wife. In other words, Herod is living in violation of the Torah by marrying his brother's wife. And so that's why he ended up being arrested and eventually beheaded. So John was not a revolutionary, and association with John the Baptist does not imply any sort of revolutionary terrorism. Here's more proof, though. Paul arrested Christians. Remember this? This goes back to a much earlier reason. Paul, according to Asher Norman's reading, which is actually something he got from Chaim Maccabi's Paul the Mythmaker, Paul is working for the Romans. He's a Roman policeman. He's a Roman undercover officer working for Caiaphas undercover to arrest anti-Roman zealots. So, proof that Jesus was a zealot is that Paul arrested Christians. And we know that Paul was an undercover policeman working for Caiaphas. Also buttressing this is that the believers were persecuted by priests and Sadducees. Priests and Sadducees were the faction of the government of the religious leadership that were in collusion with Rome. Okay, this is a really interesting one. He was being pursued by King Herod's army, he and his disciples. How do we know? Well, there was the incident of the fig tree. He came up to the fig tree and he was hungry and he needed to eat from the fig tree, but there weren't any figs, so he cursed it. Why was he so hungry? Why was he in... Because the army was chasing him. Same with the grain fields. His disciples broke the Sabbath to harvest grain on the Sabbath. Why were they so hungry? Well, this is permissible. It's permissible, according to halakha, to do something like that if your life is in danger and their lives were in danger because Herod's army was chasing them. And the proof is that his disciples picked the grain in the grain fields. And then there was the confusing thing where he said to the one disciple, or the would-be disciple, let the dead bury the dead, come follow me. Well, how does that accord with honor your father and mother? But it makes sense if they're being pursued by Herod's army. So these three incidents are cited as proof. They prove nothing. I feel like I should apologize to the whole class because I thought the book was better than this. You know, when we started this, and now here we are on 20 lessons of this. Just at a certain point, it's just dribble. There's a family that used to attend this congregation that lost their faith over Chaim Maccabi's books. Okay, disciples with zealot nicknames. I thought, such as Simon the Zealot, perhaps? Yes, the Master has zealot disciples, at least one. No doubt he had zealot disciples. They're from Galilee, for crying out loud. They're Galileans, you know. They're like, it's like from being from Texas, you know. It's like the NRA, you know. But the only one that we can definitely say has an association with zealotry, a direct association with zealotry, is Simon the Zealot. And that one is a no-brainer. Sons of Thunder, James and John? No, that could be. Maybe that means, okay, they're like sons of thunder, you know, and because of their zeal. Maybe we're never told why they're called sons of thunder. It could also be because of the experience they had on the Mount of Transfiguration. It could be. It could just be that they're impetuous, you know. Yeah, it could be they were loud. It could be that Zebedee was loud, you know. It could be referring to Zebedee's character because Zebedee is well known to the Master. His wife, Shalamet, is a follower of the Master. You know, as well as these two boys. You know, how do you think, what do you think, have you ever noticed his absence? he gets left with the nets. You know, he's like, he's still sitting in the boat. So the two boys go off. Oh, yeah, you two go off and follow your rabbi. I'll just hold down the fishing business here. And then his wife's like, I'm going too. You know? So, you know, maybe there was a little thunder.
German background, right?
Yeah. So we don't know why they're called sons of thunder. Iscariot, according to some interpretations of the name Iscariot, it might be a reference to, like, it might be a shortened sort of version of Ish Sakari, a man of the Sakari, and that was a zealot faction named after their daggers, their Sakari daggers. They were assassins. And I like that. I like that idea, that interpretation. I think there's no question that there's zealotry in the ranks of the disciples, and that there's zealotry all through the Galilee. You know, my brother always refers to it as a tinderbox waiting, a dry tinderbox waiting for a spark. And we see that it happened. I mean, within 40 years, there was a massive revolution. So it's like the population was at the breaking point already. It's to this kind of zealotry that our master speaks when he comes out teaching radical things like, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Do you think anybody wants to hear that when you're wanting to pick up swords? Blessed are you when men persecute you. How about go the extra mile, turn the cheek? These are all of those, what we would understand as sort of the pacifist teachings, are really intended as counters to zealotry. And whenever we see the master, we see the zealotry starting to take off and take over in his ministry. That's what the multitudes, the 4,000 and the 5,000, in both instances, things that's reached a point where it's reached a point where it's going to be a conflagration. In fact, in one incident, it says after he fed them, they tried to make him king by force. Mm-hmm. So what does he do after each of those incidents? He flees to get out. This explains the messianic secret that scholars are so puzzled over. My brother explains this. He says the messianic secret is, why does he not tell people who he is? Why is it like, shh, don't tell anyone? You're the Messiah. Yes, don't tell anyone. You know, he does a miracle. He says, don't tell anyone. Why all the secrecy and the sneaking around? It's because the Messiah is supposed to be a revolutionary, and he's trying to not start a revolution. Okay, so the charge that he's a zealot is completely contrary to how we see him operating and teaching. Yes. Oh, why did he choose the ones he did? Yes. A moment or two on the disciples. Why did he choose the disciples that he did? He didn't. He prayed and fasted, and the Father gave him those names, first of all. So he spent the whole night before he made the final selection of 12 up in the hills, praying and fasting all night long. And then the Father chose these. But so we've got fishermen and zealots and other kind. So the Pharisees say the same thing to him, basically. That's what they're asking when they say, why do you eat and drink with sinners? And, tax collectors. Oh, my brother always says that too. He says, oh, I'd love to hear the conversations between Matthew the tax collector and Simon the zealot. <'Cause> these are like, you know, polar opposites. Polar opposites.
I think you have to realize zealots also, the pros and cons, they may get into things, but also they're the ones that are going to live their life to the death.
Well, that's true. That's true. There is zeal. You know, zealotry comes with zeal. Yes, it does. Like Elijah said, I have been very zealous for the Lord my God, you know. And the original cry of the zealots back when Judah led the zealot movement from, what's the name of this? The Gamla. Judas of Gamla led the zealot movement back at the beginning of the first century. Their original battle cry was, God alone is king of Israel. God alone rules Israel. Now, if you think of that as like the slogan, you know, everybody had it on a button or whatever, God alone rules Israel. That's very similar to the message of the kingdom. The rule of Israel, you know, the kingdom of heaven is now. It's kind of a zealot slogan. The kingdom of heaven is now, you know. God alone rules Israel. So it's definitely, Chaim Maccabee has identified a real strong thread that is definitely present in the Gospels. How he knits that together is the problem. The next name on this list, Bar-Yonah. Apparently, in Aramaic, Bar-Yonah is a word for zealot. That's ridiculous, though, because in that would be Bar-Yonah. That's moving. That's taking. That's like Bar-Yonah is a transliteration of Hebrew. Bar-Yonah, the son of Jonah. So then if you move that, transliterate that into Greek as Bar-Yonah, and then transliterate that backwards into Aramaic. I mean, we're just going in circles here. This is crazy. So I already mentioned how he was once trying to be made king by force. The Messiah also tried to fulfill the prophecies of Zechariah, for example, by the triumphal entry on the donkey. That's right from Zechariah. You know what else is in Zechariah? All sorts of apocalyptic end times prophecies about final battles and that sort of thing. Well, so, yeah, okay. No, not my point, his point. The book of Zechariah contains prophecies about the coming of Messiah, such as lowly riding on a donkey. It also contains prophecies about a cataclysmic end times apocalyptic battle, the final battle pitting good against evil. And so if he's fulfilling the one, like, oh, look at me, I'm the guy from Zechariah, lowly riding on a donkey, then it must follow that he is trying to stir people up and prepare them for this cataclysmic end times battle. That's the idea. It's essentially true. Yes, it is. That is essentially true. He is the Messiah, prophesied by Zechariah, lowly riding on a donkey. He will come and lead in a cataclysmic, apocalyptic battle. Okay. Well, yeah, that goes into the category of the reasons we don't believe he's the Messiah, because he's, you know, fulfilling messianic prophecies. And to be fair, to be fair to the Jewish people, these are not really reasons that Jews don't believe in Jesus. These are reasons that Asher Norman concocted to dissuade Jews from believing in Jesus. But that's not the real reasons Jews don't believe in Jesus. The real reason that Jews don't believe in Jesus is because they're Jews. And Jews don't believe in Jesus. Like, the average Jewish person isn't really thinking that through. They're not like, I mean, they might if you sat them down and talked about it, but I think the average Jewish person, and I'm thinking of the average secular Jewish person, the reason they don't believe in Jesus is because they're Jewish, period, and they don't think much further than that. And why should they? I mean, why is the average Catholic Catholic? Because he's Catholic. You know, why does the average Catholic believe in Jesus? Because he's Catholic. We usually don't really think too far out of these boxes. Okay. Arrested as a zealot threat. Never mind that. Roman charges against Jesus. Claimed to be a king. He said, I bring a sword, not peace. And he committed perpetrated violent acts by clearing the temple. And he forbade the payment of taxes to Caesar. According to Asher Norman, and I'm sure he's drawing it from Chaim Maccabee, when Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, the Jewish listeners would have understood everything belongs to God. Therefore, what he's really telling us is don't pay our taxes, but he's being sneaky about it. That's pretty clever, don't you think? There's a great teaching on this. that passage, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. I can't remember where I first heard it. It might have been the Jerusalem Synoptic School. They pointed out that, you know, he asked to see a denarius. He said, whose image is on it, right? And it was Caesar's image. So he says, render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's, and render unto God what is God's. Now, if you really want to know what the Jewish background to that is, it's not that it's a code saying, don't pay taxes. What he's saying is, the coin has Caesar's image on it, so give it to Caesar. You, as a human being, have God's image. The thing that you're to render unto God, what is it that has God's image? The whole human being. So that would be the deeper meaning of the Master's words. The coin is struck with Caesar's image, but the human being is struck with God's image. He was crucified with brigands. That's true. The sign on the cross said, King of the Jews. So, revolutionary, obviously. When Peter was arrested, he was heavily guarded. And he was compared with famous zealots in Acts 12:6. Not really. You know what they're talking about? It's the Gamaliel passage, where Gamaliel says, look, in the days of Judas, that's that same Judah from Gamla. In the days of Judas, Judah, the revolutionary from Gamla, you know, a lot of people thought he was the Messiah. He turned out not to be the Messiah. So let's just, I say we just leave these people alone and see what happens. You know, if it's from God, you know, you won't be able to stop it. That's the passage. Irrelevant. Paul was arrested as a zealot. Now, after becoming a believer. This is true. He wasn't arrested as a zealot. He was arrested as a religious troublemaker. He was arrested on the charges that he had brought Gentiles into the temple. That, which wasn't true in itself. And then, when his case was transferred to a Roman court, they needed to supply charges, secular charges against him, just like they did with the Master. So what are you going to say? Well, they said, well, he stirs up riots everywhere he goes, riots against Rome. He was exonerated from those charges, though. Jesus is called another king in Acts 17:8, and his brother James was executed. Well, his brother was executed by the Sadducean high priest as well, and the Sadducean high priesthood is in collusion with Rome. So why would the Sadducean high priest bother executing James unless James was an anti-Roman revolutionary? It's sort of this, like, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it doesn't follow. It's just kind of this loose, fast and loose logic. You know, it's kind of like that. A star is a hot ball of gas that's, you know, burning, a hot burning ball of gas. Harrison Ford is a star. Harrison Ford must be a hot burning ball of gas, you know? Why was James executed? We have two accounts of the death of James. One comes from Christian sources. One comes from Josephus. And both sources agree. James is executed because he's the head of the sect, and the sect is growing in popularity. And the Christian source kind of, you know, is the more embellished one, but also, you know, it also preserves more of the story. The Josephus source just tells us, you know, the priesthood wanted to be rid of him, and the Pharisees were upset about it, about his execution. It says the leading pious of the, you know, the pious ones, it's the Pharisees. Why would the Pharisees be upset about it? Why would the priesthood want him dead? You remember when Paul stood up in the middle of the Sanhedrin and said, I am on trial here because of the resurrection of the dead. The priesthood represents the Sadducean, you know, belief system. James and the believers are Pharisee by default. because they believe in the resurrection of the dead. So the Pharisees are like Gamaliel. They're like, well, I don't think these guys are so bad. You know, so maybe a guy was resurrected. Is that so hard to believe? that's the Pharisaic line on the sect of the believers. The Sadducees, it's not even in their worldview. If you want to speak specifically to the first century situation, the Pharisees did not have political power. They had the popular power because they were pious. So people looked at them and said, these are godly men. And they, for the most part, conducted themselves as godly men. The Sadducees were the clerical elite. They had control. They had control of the temple. And they had Roman backing. So the Romans, you know, appointments, they had the money. And so they were incredibly corrupt. These people were incredibly corrupt. The Pharisees, the only reason that they had power was because of their, you know, they had a sort of a mass popularity appeal that allowed them to hold enough seats on the Sanhedrin, not that it was by election, but it allowed them to hold enough seats on the Sanhedrin that they could continue to influence or, you know, pass on decisions and that sort of thing. But it's a long history. I mean, if you really want to, you really should read Jewish War or something like that. Read Josephus' Jewish War. That's good stuff. That's fun. You'd all enjoy it. You just got to get used to those long Greek sentences. But that's you would enjoy it.
Jewish War?
Jewish War. Mm-hmm. Josephus' Jewish War. Yep. It's a trip. Okay, reason number 26. And this is it. The end. Reason 26 that... Why Jews don't believe in Jesus? The Torah provides personal salvation for Gentiles. So, how is this a reason that Jews don't believe in Jesus? Well, Christianity starts with the assumption that everyone's damned and going to hell. And in that case, then you need a savior. Yes. Judaism doesn't start with that assumption. Judaism starts with the assumption that you're not damned and going to hell. And if you just keep some basic ethical, moral statutes, you probably have a share in the world to come. What are those basic ethical, moral statutes? It's these seven Noahide laws. The seven laws that God gave to Noah. Don't worship idols. Don't commit sexual immorality. Don't eat the limb of a living animal. Don't murder. Don't blaspheme God. Don't steal. And establish courts of law in order to administer justice. These are the seven. These are the accepted seven today. There's lots of different lists. Lots of different theories. Sometimes there was as many as 30. And so different sages would offer their opinions on what the laws were. Here's an interesting thing about this, though. These laws were never presented as a means, as like proof that like this is how we know Gentiles have a share in the world to come. In the sources where they appear, they are presented as the basis on which God judges nations. Let me explain. For example, Nineveh. God sends his prophet Jonah to Nineveh, says, repent. You know, God's going to destroy this place in 40 years. You say, wait a second. On what basis? Did God ever tell these people, you know, did he give them a Torah? On what basis does God judge? Or he throws the Canaanites out, you know, he says, you know, the sin of the Amorites has reached its full measure. Well, wait. On what basis? How do they know what sin is or sin isn't? And so the sages said, well, obviously there's sort of a moral ethical core. We'll call it the laws of Noah because we see that God gave these laws to Noah, you know. And so now, then it's just a matter of discussing what they are. But they were regarded as a basis by which God could bring judgment upon the nations. That's the purpose they originally served in rabbinic literature. Nowadays, I guess they're a ticket to the world to come. As the seven... Keep the seven, go to heaven. I guess that's the answer. So Asher Norman points out that the Acts 15 laws, the four laws that the apostles give us in Acts 15 for Gentiles, have a lot of affinity with this. And he makes this statement. He says that the Acts 15 laws apparently are an abbreviated, truncated, or corrupted version of the seven laws, which is a ridiculous statement to say. Because like I said, the seven laws, there were all sorts of different lists. There were lots of versions of the seven laws. But they're not given in Acts 15 as a basis by which Gentiles can attain salvation. Instead, Peter says, at the beginning of the discussion, he says, there's no difference between the Jews and the Gentiles, Jewish and Gentile believers, in this regard, that God has cleansed our hearts by faith. So, according to Peter, the Gentiles that they were legislating these laws for were already saved by faith, by their faith, and specifically their faith in Yeshua, the Messiah. He goes on to talk about this for a little bit further in the book, brings up the circumcision question, and he points this out, which I thought was interesting. He points this out. He says, the book of Acts does not make clear that circumcision means conversion to Judaism. And he's pointing out that this is actually a very good point. He points out that this is something that Gentile readers don't understand. And he, as a Jewish reader, understands that when you have this whole argument in the New Testament about circumcision, not circumcision, it's not an argument about how to get to heaven or not get to heaven. It's an argument about whether you need to be Jewish or not. Whether a Gentile follower of Jesus needs to become Jewish. So, he says, Acts does not make clear that circumcision means conversion to Judaism. No, it doesn't. That's just something that is assumed, you know? It's something that, in those days, when these documents were written, that was just understood. James decided that Gentiles did not have to be circumcised. In other words, they didn't have to be Jewish. So now what he does is he takes this and he says, see, James agrees with the sages. Gentiles have their own gig going on. They don't need to become Jewish. They don't need to keep all the commandments. They got their own gig, and they'll go to heaven if they keep these commandments. But he then pits that against Paul, who said that you had to believe in Jesus. Doesn't work. You guys know the Bible too well for that. But if you didn't know the New Testament, if you didn't know the Bible, well, you could read this and think, wow, I guess James and Paul. Okay, that's the end of the point. You don't need Jesus, because the point is, you don't need Jesus because you're going to heaven anyway if you keep the seven laws. Conversion to Judaism. This is how he ends this point of the Torah provides personal salvation for Gentiles. Judaism does not seek converts, since all people have a share in the world to come, as determined by their works. So God judges the works of Gentiles by the seven Noahide laws.